Sounds like
Tyler,
what you want is some is one of these tether. The company I usually go after stuff like that for is Tether Tools, and they have this thing called a T setup that is that looks like it's designed to be build an arm that's to hold a camera facing straight down. But that's a camera shop, so you're going to be paying, you know, photography prices for tools.
Yeah. I mean, but Lee's right. It's not terribly sophisticated. It's just, I just need to find the pieces and parts to put it together, right? It's a tripod with a stand that can hold my phone and point it straight down onto my desk so I can draw.
Hey, Robert?
Yo.
I just dug my tripod out from under the counter. It does right angles. So if you can mount your phone on a standard tripod, you can put it over your tablet, over your paper.
Dan, Lee, do me a favor, take a picture of what you got and send it to me. I'm curious because I have not been able to figure it out on how to do it on my tripod.
You mean you can't point your camera straight down on the tripod?
Well, it's the camera is my phone, right?
Yeah. Well, you need a holder for the phone. A phone holder for your tripod.
And maybe that's what I'm missing. And if that's all I'm missing, well, I need a phone.
$7.95 on Amazon.
Sweet.
Tripod phone holder mount. Now, the only thing you have to worry about is how you're going to clear your what's under it to get it, be able to have a clear space to write on. So a regular tripod with all the braces under it wouldn't work. But I've got another tripod that just has three legs and a head. And that would easily stand over, 8x10 or 11x14 piece of paper.
That's probably why you need one of these arms or some thing to extend to that will you can screw into the tripod and it will put it out. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's here's another one: universal phone tripod mount that has an angle adjustment and an arm on it. It would go out about 6 inches, probably.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm looking for is the old and one of the old overhead projectors with a phone mount. That's exactly what I'm looking for, right?
Well, don't you know anybody has a wood shop? You just cut a couple of pieces of plywood and screw them together and mount your camera in the middle of it.
The answer is no, I don't.
Oh.
Go look for it at a makerspace.
Yeah,
and that's in my queue of things. We've got a makerspace here in Albuquerque, and unfortunately, it's been shut down because of COVID. But hopefully, things are opening up. So I'm hoping they're going to be open up soon. And they may already have something.
You just need to buy yourself a new drone and put it in hover mode right over your desk.
Nice.
But then he runs out into problems at the 20-minute mark, let alone the constant droning of that thing in his mic.
You need those new CIA silent drones that you can't hear.
Joe B. In the chat had a suggestion that went in the other direction of technology. His suggestion is a selfie stick, a tripod, and duct tape. You can always get something with duct tape.
And I know if we're going duct tape, then
how about just a webcam mounted on the ceiling?
Yeah.
A webcam probably wouldn't give you high enough resolution.
I mean, the other option is just take some string and tie my phone to one end, and the other end put it on the phone or put it on the ceiling. The only problem there is now you've got the as soon as you let go, it's going to oscillate just a little bit, and that's going to make a lot of people seasick.
Besides keeping it level.
Yeah.
No, does your tripod have any braces under the head between the legs?
It does. It does.
Okay, well, that's not going to work.
Yeah, but if I have it, I like the idea of basically you take the selfie stick, right, and use duct tape and attach it to the top of the tripod. As long as I don't bump anything, you know, it might work.
Well, first off, duct tape isn't going to work. You have to use a clamp. Otherwise, there won't be any way to hold it solid. So you might have to go by a hardware store and get yourself a squeeze clamp.
Got one of those already, so I'll use that.
We're going to a hardware store. Just go get some pipe with a right angle screw on right angle.
Robert, stop by the store, get a 3-foot piece of, say, 1-inch aluminum angle, drill a hole in one end and put a 1/4-inch nut on top of your tripod bolt and tighten it down. And then you got a horizontal surface to a rubber band your phone to.
There you go.
It costs you total about $4.
Yeah, that might work. I like it.
Looking forward to that presentation.
I'd make an overhead tripod stand. overhead camera stand. There you go.
And be sure to get the thinnest aluminum angle you can find, because the tripod bolts are only about 1/4-inch long. So you need something that you can put under the bolt and still tighten it down on 1/4-inch bolt.
Yeah. Good point.
By the way, Tyler, you posted some time ago in the presentation, 9/22 actually, you put a post to about a YouTube video. You want to quickly explain what that is?
That is a Gorse utility, and it reads the Git repository and then will play back in video form a visual representation of all the changes to the Git repository. I believe the one that I put up there is the Linux kernel for a year or two.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay. Yeah, that'll be entertaining. Cool.
It's just some utility. It's just a utility that somebody came up that will visualize Git repositories.
So. Gary, you said something about Git having a new release out. Did I get you right on that?
Yes. Came out. I think I put it on the calendar. Let me go back and find it. But it was just in the last week. I forget exactly what day. But I think it's on
The email you sent out was OpenSUSE.
It's two different things.
Okay.
There was an OpenSUSE release that Jonathan Drews pointed out, and then I commented on, but there's also a Git release. I know where I put it. I mentioned it in the email I sent out to discuss and to announce about the talk tonight. So it's mentioned in there. Along with a reference to, I forget whether it's from Foronix or Ars Technica or the Register, but wherever I read that. Let's see.
Did they add any new commands that you remember, or is it just some minor updates?
Nothing that meant anything to me, but maybe to somebody who is more attuned, they may have been more odd, but I didn't think anything was a big new update. But like I say, I'm...
Yeah, I started using the git restore command quite a bit. It's a nice little utility. If you've got something in your working directory that you've changed from the time you staged it, so for example, you edit it, you added it to the staging directory, then you edited it again and you go, oh, I don't want that one. If you do git restore of that file, it will bring you back to your previously added in the staging. So it's kind of like a little mini commit, I guess, or whatever, or mini checkout, I guess. And comes in really handy. I use it quite a bit.
Okay. Yeah. By the way, in the In the discuss thing, the last couple lines of it, I put in there, the new release is Git 2.32, and the article was from Foronix, and the URL for that article is in there.
Cool.
I'll repost it to the chat here in a second. And chat is disabled. Hello.
Interesting.
That piece of crap Apple machine you got, Gary.
Yeah, it was working 10 minutes ago. It was working.
It's
I can not, read chat now, but I can't post anything to chat.
It's working for me.
Really?
Yeah.
Hell.
Not working for me.
That's because you're a host, Lee. It has to do with stopping and starting the recording.
Yeah, okay. I see Lee's hello, but I can't put one out. Damn. Okay.
Well, Tyler can post, but he's not a host.
I think somebody disabled chat since I posted.
Oh, you can't post anymore, Tyler?
No, I can't.
You can. Okay.
I can't.
Oh, you cannot.
Cannot.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm guessing that it has to do with the fact that we stopped the recording and then started it again, and therefore the chat was saved, and so it's not allowing any new chats. That would be my guess.
Okay.
Or maybe the new recording was started with the chat disabled.
Try it now.
Oh, that did it.
I didn't know you could disable chat.
So you, in other words, when you start the recording, you either have to have the chat enabled or disabled?
No.
Oh, just a host can enable and disable?
Yeah, apparently I disabled it somehow or another. All these buttons are confusing.
Okay, in the bottom of the chat, I posted the URL for the Foronix article on Git 2.32.
I mean, that's why I was asking about the disabled chat when Ed asked that we not chat him, but we decided that private chats were okay.
Oh, I got something to report.
What's that?
So I went that machine I showed off last week.
Yeah.
The last time. It's now sitting in my main computer, and it's running Linux Mint. How should I put this? Windows is now sitting in a VM in the background. You know, like it's called up when I have to use it. And actually, it's running in like 80 to 90% of my Steam library right now without any fighting. So I guess I owe somebody a beer.
Wow.
That was a royal pain last time I attempted this.
Yeah, what was this original problem? I mean, you found the solution. What was the problem?
I upgraded and I decided I did not want to deal with Windows garbage anymore. So I installed Linux Mint on my PC.
You upgraded what? You went out and bought a new PC?
I went out and bought a new processor, memory, and motherboard. And
yeah, okay, yeah, whatever. A new PC, yeah. A hand-built, but a new PC, yeah.
Yeah. So instead of setting up Windows this time around, I said, we're going to try Mint first, and only if I can't get the virtual machine to do what I need to, then we'll revert back. So far, it's been perfectly suitable for me.
Yeah, I don't think there's driver issues. I think as long as the machine is beefy enough, because Windows is a hog.
Right.
Oh.
I've beefy. I got a 5900X AMD Ryzen processor in here with 64 gig of memory and a PCIe 4. It literally boots up in a blink of an eye.
Yeah, I mean, it's beefy in all ways. I mean, Windows is a disk hog, a CPU hog, and a memory hog.
So, yes, Windows now sits as a jailed VM in the back of my system with Linux Mint doing everything that I would normally do. The biggest problem I keep on running into is every time I try to tear off a tab in Vivaldi to make a new window, it tries to copy the website to the desktop. Hmm. Don't know what's up with that.
I mean, the Vivaldi's running in Windows?
No, Vivaldi's running on Linux. I went around and installed it.
Then I don't copy it to what desktop? To your Linux desktop?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it saves the web page instead of. So I have this bad habit. If I want a new browser window, I'll grab a new tab and I'll grab it and tear it off that window and drop it somewhere else on the desktop.
Yeah,
which will spawn a new browser window.
Supposed to. Instead, it's saving it as a file on the desktop.
Yeah, it's saying instead of running and basically it's just me retraining myself to go over to the taskbar and poking the button again to come up with a new window.
That's probably a bug in Vivaldi. I do that a lot with I don't use Vivaldi, but I use every other browser: Firefox, Pale Moon, IceCat, WaterFox, I don't remember. And I don't have that problem. And I'm a Mint guy. So I think it's a Vivaldi problem, not a Mint problem.
So yeah, Windows finally pissed me off enough that I decided to go walk away from it. Yeah.
About time.
So Robert wants to know if, I guess, a hypervisor would be a very low level hypervisor instead of a full. I mean, like, let me ask Tyler, which VM server did you pick?
I believe I installed KVM and I'm using Vert Manager to manage the machine.
Yeah, my experience is with VirtualBox, but I'm sure there are lots of other virtual machine servers out there.
Well, VirtualBox has better desktop integration. If you ever run into problems like that, Tyler, you might want to switch.
You know, Robert's can you run just a hypervisor right on bare metal without running it in an OS?
Well, from what I understand, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, a hypervisor is a micro operating system that all it knows is how to do is run a virtual machine. That's all it does. It boots up, it starts up the network, and it starts and manages virtual machines.
Yeah, and how it does is what makes a difference. If you run it on your SUSE or Mint desktop, it's a desktop app, it's VirtualBox. If you run it straight on the kernel, it's Vert Manager and KVM or Xen. If you run it on bare metal, then you got something like VMware or Xen, the bare metal version of Xen.
Proxmox, something like that.
Yeah.
It's a hypervisor. So I installed KVM. I installed the Vert Manager. I tried using boxes, but it kept on crashing on the display. Don't know why.
I've never tried. Does Vert Manager give you a clipboard?
As long as you install the driver, you want me to share my screen and show you?
Well, I can try it real quick.
Well, I'll stop sharing mine.
Where the virtual machine at? Okay. Crud, I don't have any with X on them. None of my Zen VMs have run X. Sorry.
Well, it's a VM. Just create a snapshot and install one.
You want to test it with Windows? You know, you can't install Windows in 5 minutes.
No, I mean, don't you have a Windows VM, right?
Oh, that's new.
Not on VirtualBox. I use VirtualBox for all my Windows VMs because you get good desktop integration.
Yeah.
So, Lee, it is Windows. Are you running Windows with VirtualBox, or are you running Linux with VirtualBox and then running Windows in that?
You lost me.
Wait, so Windows, is it a VM or is it on bare metal?
That's insulting, Robert.
Well, I know what the answer is.
Yeah, I don't have Windows on bare metal anywhere within a mile of me.
That's what I figured. So then what Stanford is saying is right. So you're running it in a VM, just take a snapshot of it as a VM and then do whatever you want to do. And if it blows up, just revert.
No, that's not the question. He wants to know if the clipboard works with the Windows VM under Vert Manager.
Ah. Sorry, I thought it was installing some software. I missed it. Sorry.
No. I've got 20 Windows VMs for different things, and I use the bidirectional clipboard all the time, as well as USB mapping to the host and network shares and stuff like that.
Sure. It's a way to go.
But the question is, Tyler is using Vert Manage, and I don't know if that works.
Well, the clipboard works. I have to look at what I put in here to actually get the clipboard integration to work, because, you know, it's now history in PowerShell.
But Lee, what is missing the X server, the Vert Manager?
No. I don't have any Windows VMs not running on VirtualBox. And the ones I have had accessible on Vert Manager don't have X. Although I do have I did find one here out on a client site, and the clipboard does not work.
Yeah, I mean, it's better that you went looking for one. I was just saying, pick one, take a snapshot of it, and install an X server. But you found one that had X server.
That's a dumb idea, Stanford. I'm not going to spend half an hour fritzing around with something like that.
Well, I mean, whatever. I don't know if it's a half an hour, but it's... I guess you're right. I mean, a Windows install on... Right. Windows installs are not as simple as apt-get install.
Right. And
you sure about that?
Not on a Linux machine.
So Lee, different question about your setup. So what's your obviously you're running VirtualBox. Underneath that, what are you running VirtualBox on top of? What's your OS?
SUSE. I've been using SUSE for about 20 years ever since, and it's never did me wrong.
But you're still using that. How would you say, if you want to run SUSE, you don't run SUSE in a VM. You just run your SUSE as is, right? At the bare metal one.
SUSE, Debian, and Raspbian are the only OSs that run on bare metal around here.
But do you run them in VMs as well? In other words, one strategy that I was thinking of is have a bare minimum OS Linux install, run your VirtualBox, and then within your VirtualBox, you create a VM that runs whatever OS you want, whatever distro you want, right?
VirtualBox requires a full OS, including a Windows server, X Windows or whatever.
Got it. Okay, fair enough.
You know, Vert Manage will allow you to use a minimal OS without a GUI and run virtual machines and access them with an SSH link. And the GUI across the SSH uses, I believe, the SPICE protocol. So I can log into the GUI on machines all over the country with an SSH link from Vert Manager on my machine.
Gotcha.
And I would do what you're saying, run a full Linux VM inside of a Linux host. But Lee would tell you, no, that second Linux machine just needs to be a container.
No, that's not right, Stanford. I have Linux VMs all over the place. I'm saying I don't need GUIs on them, so I don't install X Windows on them.
Oh, okay.
Okay. That's totally different than taking one particular workload and running it in a container or a set of containers. Like one of the things I'd like to see your Jupyter Labs in a container.
That's what you're looking at. That's what I was doing.
No, what I'm saying is how to do it.
That would be just setting up the Jupyter Lab. Well, locally.
So I guess you access it with a browser. Is that the idea?
Yeah. If you want it server based, it's this Jupyter Hub package. So there's these little Jupyter Hubs that you can build out, and it will just be Jupyter set up there.
I don't see a container. If I could throw that. Is there a... Where is your container? Or how does that work? If you want to run Jupyter, why do you need a hub out there somewhere in the cloud?
Because Jupyter... Jupyter Notebooks is designed to be installed locally, and you interact with it through the browser.
Right. Okay.
Jupyter Hub is the official package that is designed to be, okay, I'm going to build a server with authentication and all that rot that will build out, that will allow me to run Jupyter Notebooks on a dedicated server.
Now, is that the container you're using, Robert?
Well, hold on. Let me share my screen. Is that okay, Tyler?
Yeah. Other than I put a link in this for Lee. I use Chocolaty as the package manager in my Windows boxes.
Mm-hmm.
This Vert IO drivers. I believe is what I had to install to get Windows to accept clipboards.
Okay.
So Lee, are you able to see my screen?
Yeah. Docker.
That's what I do.
Jupyter Enable Lab. Okay, so that looks like just a dot container that runs a notebook or whatever notebooks you have configured out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it runs the service, right? And so I'm sharing up, or I'm mounting in with the dash D option my current directory, right? Which happened to be, I call it git part two, right?
Right.
And then when it fires up, that's what it displays, right? So, here's my folder, right? I can go up one. Here it is. Here's git part two.
Okay. So basically you see that folder in your UI there. And then you can create separate, or basically you map that to a host directory somewhere. Yep. And then wherever you need it, you spin up the container, it maps the host, and then you get access your work. So Jupyter Hub then is basically like GitHub functionally. It allows remote users with authentication to share notebooks, and then you can set up teams and groups and all kinds of stuff on there, I guess.
I believe so. That I haven't actually installed it, but that's basically it.
Okay. So if I wanted to play with it, I just set up a container like Robert's using here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the setup that I happen to be is, you know, it's got a, you know, two other layers. I'm running it on an AWS instance, and I'm doing SSH tunneling. But that command that I've highlighted right there,
right,
you can just run that. If you've got Docker local on your laptop,
yeah,
boom, you're up and running. You're ready
now,
to go.
Now. Okay, Stanford, you still here? You still with us?
I'm still listening.
Okay, look at what's highlighted.
Yes, I'm listening.
That launches a container to give you a Jupyter program on your machine without physically touching anything on your machine.
Yeah. As long as you have Docker, that will.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and anybody with a Linux box has Docker if they wanted, you know, just simple install, zipper install Docker.
But right, it's installing that Jupyter / data science notebook image, and it's just
right
deploying it.
So the Jupyter data science notebook image would be, that's like, I mean, so it's not a VM, it's a container. Is that it?
Right.
You just go out and download that container from somewhere.
Right. The Docker service gives you a standard OS API for anything you need from the host. And the container gives you anything you need to run that application.
So this Jupyter notebook, you're running, like I said, there's a Linux kernel underneath. Doesn't matter whether it's Debian or Red Hat or whatever.
There's a Linux kernel underneath the Docker daemon that makes no difference whatsoever to the container.
Right, and then the Docker, and so this notebook is what? It is another Linux OS?
No, it is.
No, it's a Python application.
It's a Python application. It is an application, and within that container is all the code you need to run that application and nothing else.
It's a Python application that is a notebook. It makes it look like you've got a laptop.
No, it makes it look like you have a notebook.
We're notebook in this case is more like a traditional science notebook, right? It's got you jot notes down. It's not like a laptop.
Okay, not a laptop, not a DVD. Not a laptop without a DVD. It's a notepad, a notebook.
Right.
Scratch pad.
And like I was saying before, that container image intact will run on any Linux distro.
Well, it'll love run on Windows and Mac too.
Oh, okay. Well, I've seen that not happen, but then those are much more complicated containers.
What I'm saying is that what you're seeing here, the reason why I did it on AWS is just because I wanted to make sure that if something happened on my network, that I can just do something else and boom, I can just reconnect to my my AWS instance. But I had this running on my Mac earlier.
Yeah. What he means to what he's saying though is that the Jupyter container will run anywhere because it's Python based. Other containers that are more meant to mimic OSs, they may struggle.
It's not the OS. Some Microsoft applications have to be built to run on Windows or Linux. There are two different versions of them.
Yeah.
Like SQL Server. There's a Linux version, there's a Windows version. I stubbed my toe on that a couple of years ago when I set up SQL Server for a client. So
are you saying they put SQL Server in a container?
Yeah. I did it years ago.
Oh, wow. That sounds painful.
No, it's trivial. In fact, I did a presentation on it. You know, it took me about an hour to, it took me about 10 minutes to set it up and then about another hour to learn how to use it. And then I imported all their access data into SQL Server. I got running on my Linux machine here. I got it running on a server out of the client. And it works great.
So what you're talking about is you're talking about a Windows container running under Linux. Is that fair to say?
No, it is a specific version of SQL Server built for Linux. The Windows version of the SQL Server container runs on Windows. You know, there are some containers that have to run on the host OS they are built for.
Got it.
You know, so most of them are fine, but you will stub your toe once in a while, and that happened to me.
And out of curiosity, for the Windows containers, can you just write a Docker file and have it build the container just like in Linux?
Yeah.
So all that pain when you install Docker, it will install Hyper-V, but beyond that, it works just the same way it does on the other platforms.
What I'm getting at is all that pain and suffering that you had with SQL Server, Lee. All you need, you know, you write that into a Docker file, and boom, you're good to go. Fair to say?
There was no pain at that point, because when I figured out you couldn't run the Windows container on Linux, I did a quick search and found the Linux SQL Server container, and then it was a simple install.
That was the pain.
Yeah. The downside is like one and a half gig. It's huge compared to normal containers.
But a VM.
Yeah, it's Microsoft. What did you expect?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
But a VM would be even bigger, right, Lee?
Well, yeah, a VM would be an entire OS. You know, you're talking, you know, at least 20 gig there.
And a performance hit with it too.
Yeah.
Okay, you're making me want to go in and rebuild my Redmine tomorrow. as I can, and or whatever. Think about which one probably the Redmine, because that's where I just started. But you're right. We got stupid. Somebody decided that our primary Nagios box would run inside a VM. It's like, no, that can run in a container.
I probably wouldn't do that. You know, I would always want Nagios on dedicated hardware.
We did both ways. Off-site, we did it dedicated hardware. In-house, we ran it in a VM. I don't know why.
If you were to do it on in a VM, you would what? Use Ansible or Vagrant or something like that to create the VM? Configure the VM?
Way overkill. A simple, 200 meg OS install plus install the Nagios package, whatever you got, and then you build the checks you want to use.
But like you guys are just saying, why would you put it in a VM? Why not just put Nagios in a container? You know, if you're not going to run it on bare metal, why not just put it in a container?
Well, then you have at least two other failure points. You know, the whole reason to run Nagios is you want it to be there if everything else craps out.
Right. It's, I mean, the, yeah, I mean, you know, when everything else craps out, you're going to know it. You know, the thing you want to be there when everything else craps out is Redmine, so that you can read your notes on how to do restores.
Well, that's why I built Redmine in a container. But the other thing, if you're going to do it right, Stanford, you need to put Redmine in a container and build yourself a flipping load balancer container in front of it.
Yeah, which is also going to be in a container.
heaven helps the day that I put my stuff into a container.
Why do I need a load balancer? What's that going to do for me?
Because that way you can handle SSL and you can handle security and you can handle your different hosts you need for SVN and stuff like that with separate authentication. So that way you don't run into problems with people putting an HTTP, which is BARF in the first place, and getting into your SVN repository without security. You don't put that on the same server configuration. You put it in a separate container. And then your load balancer distributes the URLs as needed, as well as handling the SSL for you up front.
Okay. But it's like you said, it's all internal customers. It's not external. So the security isn't the top priority.
Well, yeah, that's even riskier. I used to know some of the people that worked around down there. You wouldn't want them touching your repository.
yeah, but they're also, I don't know. They're not that, we're down to 15 people and most of them don't know what they're doing. So it's mostly just a matter of keeping them out and not worry about them hacking.
Yeah.
And the boss has decided to outsource to the evil empire.
Well, at least you can't touch your stuff. RCP and all that stuff is Linux only.
Yeah, I mean he's gonna turn over as much of the infrastructure as he can to have you ever heard of the company Americom?
No.
And they're a Microsoft Silver provider somewhere in the Kirkwood area. So yeah, we're gonna lose everything except our development machines, which is fine. That's off load off my back.
Well, except you're going to get mighty pissed off when you can't log into a machine because your AD authentication is down.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, they say they have 24/7 support, so we'll see.
Oh, that's when you register a ticket and you hold them to it. What are we down to? Office 362? 359?
Why would anybody ever want to use an online program? I can't comprehend that. You know, but then again, I deal with very few muggles, so.
Is that what we call non-technical people?
That's a nice Linux? Term for them. That's a nice term for them.
All right, folks, I got to take off. Does anybody have any questions about Git or anything?
Thank you.
I think we're good, Robert. Really appreciate it because it's 11:30 up there. So get, you know, crash. Go crash.
Thank you very, very, very much, Robert. It's been a great, great presentation.
We'll talk to you later and I'll shoot out an email when I've got stuff in GitHub.
All righty.
Thank you, sir.
All right, guys. You guys all have a good one, huh?
You okay. Too.
Bye.
Good night.
Nope, anybody else? I'm late for my hot tub time.
I was going to say, it's beginning to look like maybe the party's over.
Okay.
Can we stop the recording now?
I guess we can stop the recording now.